I think that Holy Week can be tricky because we don't know what to do with our hands. You see, on Palm Sunday, we had palms and we waved them. And even now, as we found a place on the floor for them, there was a sense in which they had so much purpose for that moment, being the regaling peace of the Lord our God who is coming. And then suddenly we put them down and they sit down and then we face Holy Week. What do we do with our hands? The festal mood blurs. And our arms, which had been given over to waving as we gave ourselves over into a liberating possibility, perhaps they were even prostrate on the ground in the dust as we admitted where it was that we have been vulnerable. Now, in the weeks to come, in the days to come, in the moments, in the minutes, our hands just aren't going to be quite so busy after Jesus has marched by into the next phase of the journey into the heart of empire. Our hands are empty again, or worse, busy again with the ordinary everyday work that keeps this Jesus Day of celebration from being the game changer that delivers us, waking the next morning, stirring the breakfast, feeding the animals and the children, checking on the news. All the while wondering what Jesus is up to, sunken deeper into the depths of Jerusalem. What is there that he can do? And how can we accompany him? And how can our little fingers and hands find a way of not grabbing too tightly to that which we can't hold, but to letting go and praising even as we see him into the phases we know that will come? I'm not sure, especially in this nation, in this country, that we know what to do with Holy Week in our hands, but sometimes we learn from those who come from other places or the indigenous traditions that have sprouted out and sometimes become silenced. I was reading about the tradition of those in Antigua, Guatemala, and in other places throughout Mexico and Central America. Alfombras de azarín, sawdust carpets. Have you seen these? Beautiful, festal sawdust carpets by which you take the remnants of the earth, the sawdust from all the good work that you've been doing 9 to 5, and you find little bits of flowers and pine needles and all of the remnants of the natural world and earth, and you make beautiful tapestries on the ground. You find a layer of sand, and then you start to weave beautiful images of birds. Birds, why? Because they are signs of liberation and might point us to the one who liberates us. There would be images of flowers and Jesus and all of the things that are indigenous to that community by which there might be an expectation of some peace. But wow, the painstaking process of gathering colored sawdust, dyeing it, and putting it in patterns. There are stencils by which you can work and put some together. The longest charted one, the last I saw, was 6,600 feet. Wow. Yeah, in Guatemala. That made a record. I don't know if that's been broken since. Do you know how many people and families and children it requires to get those stencils in place, to get those and gather those materials, and then somehow make something of exquisite beauty on the earth, that which is so everyday trampled by human feet? The miraculous thing is that shortly thereafter, after all of the work that has gone into those days in which the hands were busy lavishly pouring into the ground this beauty, what's going to happen when you look up and the processions start to come, as they will Thursday into Friday and into Saturday? Can you imagine that moment in which you look down? I guess we liken it somewhat to parades, where we make those big old floats for football games. Except this blood and sweat and tears of ordinary and elite people that would be on the dust of the ground, it's ephemeral art. It's ephemeral art, that which is temporary and not meant in its same form to last. It's not meant to last in the way that it was poured out. It reminded me of Mary, you know, when she gets that expensive oil. And she takes it in a prefiguring of what is to come of Christ, and she takes it out of the bottle. And there are those who on the sidelines would tell her about how much it cost. And all she does is lavishly uses her hands to pour it out and her hair to pour it out on Jesus and say how exquisitely beautiful the moment is. And Jesus sees that beauty. And for those exquisite moments, the smell in the air is that of God's sweetness and a depth and a rich, loving outpouring that is all of who she is. And Jesus is able to meet that. I like thinking about how these hands and fingers come together in their lavish outpouring of things that many of us, in looking at it, or others could say, looking in on that culture and those people and say, what a waste, right? Because what happens, but one minute it's there and the next it's not there, and what if it rains? But you can see pictures of what does happen when the tromping comes and the people who are carrying the floats on their shoulders start to walk over what is so beautiful. And you think it becomes less beautiful, but what's left behind is these muddled waves of color, more indistinct than they were before. But it also represents the giving over as in a wave into what will come with that cross. And what we can't predict to be perfect and certainly is not what we imagine or would want for someone we would call a king. It seems so foolish, doesn't it, to give ourselves over unto the work of our hands. And yet we relinquish ourselves into the counter narrative that says no matter how neatly structured we might put something into being, that God is going to be making and trampling into something else. This counter-narrative of Jesus. For Jesus is no Judas. That is, no Judas Maccabeus. 200 years earlier, that Judas, which is recounted in much of the Hebrew scriptures and some that we recognize through the Catholic Church, those of the Greco-Macedonian powers had taken over the temple and had come in and seized power with foreign domination, and they had killed and slaughtered people and prevented the worship in the temple, instead replacing what was for the Israelites most holy with images of Zeus and pagan gods. And so for a long time, the deep sense of oppression was there. All of the festal rituals, which would have been a part of the people, were squashed, and they did not know the voice of which they could find themselves again. But uprising happened. Judas Maccabeus, coming from a lineage of the Maccabeans, came into the city, and as he did so, the people that he was with took to slaughtering those who had been slaughtering his people. For this was the only way they could see to outsee that power, and to put back into rule what they imagined their God would want and how they could live out their force as a people. We get the story of Hanukkah through this succession of events. And we certainly could have some judgment on how violent it was, but in that time, that's what they felt it had to be in order to take back the power there in the hot seat of Jerusalem. And it was then, as Judas would delayingly come to town, that there would be palms and branches that come from the Hebrew tradition through the Old Testament as what you do when you have a victory. What you do when you believe that God has helped to bring about a victory. And there was such great longing that was met through this power. And yet, can you imagine the blood of the streets? Can you imagine not the festal vibrancy as it may have come about on hearts, but still people knew that their ancestors, their people, their families had died, and now too surrounded by all these yet who had died. No, Jesus is no Judas. Even though that's what people might expect and want, because the stories have passed on throughout those 200 years, and they sense that this is the moment is hot. And we get the sense that if Jesus was meant or wanted to live out his glory in this way, that people would have found weapons and would have used them violently. And yet that's, of course, what we know does not happen as easily as it could have. It's this unorthodox Jesus who has been miraculous and moody all throughout those Gospels, His reputation has preceded him, and he could not just stir up excitement, but that revolution. It must have been thrilling and terrifying to see him coming down from Bethany, the house of the poor, where he got that donkey, coming to the houses of power. But like the Maccabeans, he does focus on temple worship, and he goes in, and do you remember this? Takes the whip and clears out. But unlike the Maccabeans, does not slaughter or bring those who would kill, instead just whipping out the exploitation of those who would be poor, trying to get sacrifices for the vestal occasions. The worship task group was wary of heroism as we discussed Jesus this past week. The word hero, we felt, has been stretched and pulled, and superheroes have taken it in their own whips. I saw Wonder Woman not too long ago. And this matching violence for violence in the warlike triumphalism, this is a genre that is very known to us, that we derive some sense of glory and power and excitement and thrilling nature of being from. However, it's a lot more unexpected than that. The Palm Sunday invitation continues inviting us to turn away from the God who is supposed to be in all of our earthly sense of glory. And in our estimation, according to what we know of earthly power, we give ourselves over humbly to a God who is and is becoming in each particle of the universe, each bit of sawdust, each little pine needle, each bit of flower, a humble part. It's a process of our own disillusionment when we expose the lies that we have taken for truth. That is what Jesus does. He exposes the... He does and is doing. He exposes the lies that we have taken for truth. And what does he replace them with? The humblest of animals. Donkey dung. Don't you think it got messy there on the road? He will enter the seat of power and dissolve our fantasy and take what we want God to be and, despite our protests, become what we most need. He will shed light on our idolatry and keep us from being palm-waving posers or the fair-weather faithful. Jesus is the one who confronts evil when he hears it. It's the Pharisees who would try to silence him in that moment, and all those who are waving Hosanna. Those who would silence the voices seeking salvation, it is the Pharisees and their split allegiances, for they are caught up in the power systems of the day, curious and always hovering about Jesus. Aren't they always hovering with their commentary? Anxious that he will upset the balance between powers they have wedged out of the system. Righteously not the Jewish elite, attempting to upset the power they wield in some ways. They are also against Roman assimilation, but willing to connect with Rome when necessary to wield some power among the Jewish elite. Pharisees focused on the laws that would both set them apart in piety and resist the previous power structures, they were conflicted. So as people are gathering their palms and getting their cloaks, there are those who would be standing on the sidelines, not sure of how to interact with this miraculous thing in front of them, but knowing that something is at stake and knowing that some part of them and their power is at stake if this Jesus has his way. Author and activist from Seminary of the Streets in Oakland, Nicola Torbett, likens Pharisees to progressive white people. Stick with me. Because they are perpetually conflicted. Those who tend to oppose racism, yet self-interest puts them in line with white-denominated society. In seeking to counter their own self-interest, they would have to do so in order to dismantle the systems of oppression that at some level they benefit from disproportionately. In Luke's gospel, we, if you noticed, in the outpouring and the telling, it's the only of the gospels really that there's no real luxury of the palm branches themselves. It's the cloaks of those whose hearts who have been open to the message so much that they give lavishly of what they had. the very clothes off of their backs. There's a vulnerability there that whites can especially learn from, and I count myself in this. When the convenience of the trees are not at hand, some other something, there's a question of what we will use our hands for. And in our own guardedness and in the fear that comes with our own sense of identity, do you think that sometimes you sense a degree of rigidity that is difficult to praise from? I think it's some of that conflictedness that is the fear of exposing who we really are and taking off the coats that would keep us warm, the very lifeblood, because in Jesus' time, the coat, the cloak was so very important. Giving it over to others, exposing our own fragility, and extravagantly placing what we have in solidarity with the dust of the earth that would Jesus welcome and usher Jesus in. It's a special brand of fear and guardedness that would leave us numb and rigid, difficult in our bodies, giving ourselves over to praise, and we are yet in our conflictedness asked to give our hands over to something beyond ourselves. In the sawdust of self-denial that we face the next steps of the jarring journey. I remember one day when I was working at the Johns Hopkins Hospital and I was walking from the hospital down to Fells Point where I lived. And I'd been on call that night, and I think there had been multiple calls because I was on the pager and I got called for every code that there was. Everybody who may be at the brink of death or otherwise need comfort and a referral overnight. And so after my report in the morning around the staff table, I would, with my bleary eyes, start to walk home. And it was Good Friday. And although the neighborhood where I was living was gentrifying, there were still elements of those who'd come from Mexico. And so as I went, most unexpectedly, I happened into the seven last stations, the seven words of Jesus as it tromped along throughout the neighborhood there on my way south. I like to think that some people on that Palm Sunday day just walked into it and meandered and found a festival happening and had to say, what is it that we're doing? But something so contagious about that energy meant that they had to do it too. And that's how it was, except the energy was somber, and I knew that I was entering into something sacred that was a continuation of the work that had been at the seat of death the night before, as people took a large cross and they took turns carrying it to different people's homes on their route. And in Spanish, there were hymns I did not know, but I knew, that were calling out. And they welcomed me into that, not with a lot of words, but just by making space as we walked along the street. There wasn't an opportunity really to stand by and watch them go, nor an opportunity to cast judgment from afar. There was simply the invitation into something greater than myself. And instead of my hands on code pagers or reaching for the doorknob of my home so I could sleep again, it was God who met me in the dastardly sleeplessness of my reality and made for me Good Friday, an experience in which I then knew what it was to do with my hands and my body in this oppressive world. There was information for me in that, to watch people walk along until it was time for me to go home. Yes, we don't always have a lot to guide us through Holy Week, and I know there's a sense in which we've got a lot going on this coming Holy Week. I hope that you find your rhythm in it somewhere. Whether it's a conversation on death on Tuesday, after you've been doing your memorial planning and filling out your advanced directives, if you've been in those places in the hospital and know what it means to have a little bit of a semblance of what might happen whenever it might happen when we are earthly taken from this life into something next. Maybe you're come on Thursday as Jean and I lead that opportunity for communion, as we sit around a circle and think about the common elements by which Jesus was taking bread and a cup and inviting us into the universe of possibility. through his sacrifice. Maybe you'll be here at the Seder with a festal mood that will continue with these palms as we seek to understand what it means to live into the liberation. And although there is toil on so many days of the week, what it means when you let go and meet your brother and sister and whoever and however you identify across from you into letting go and breaking bread into feast. And then maybe it's Good Friday, as a drama comes about that Liz has been working so mightily put together and could use some more help on. Please see her afterwards. The songs that will come into that experience by which we acknowledge that Jesus was stepping further into empire. And that although we cannot accompany him all of the way there, and indeed we might scatter like the wind when it comes in the face of the deepest of persecutions, that we, wherever we are called to do something with our hands, with our hearts. So even if it's none of those options, how can we full bodily live into Holy Week, trusting that as we take off our cloaks, God can like what God sees, even if it's difficult for us to be naked. Our salvation comes not from the locus of power, but from the house of the poor. Jesus on a measly donkey. Here would we be called to join in the sawdust holiness, preparing a way for Holy Week that aligns us with a brown-bodied Savior. A humble contribution that does not rush to reconciliation, but instead hears the voices, the songs on the street, those which we know but yet don't know, down deep, calling out for liberation. How can we dare to join in instead of remaining on the sidelines, casting our own commentary? For Jesus is arriving not in a time of machinery, but with disillusionment. Whatever we would trust and thrust on God that smacks of ourself, Jesus is seeking to trample one step at a time. It is the kind of back-breaking gift on the carpets of sawdust that joins Jesus in dismantling the weaponry of war. For when you are zeroed in on the details of the pathway, what paves the feet of God, who is yet coming, you cannot carry machine guns that would slaughter the innocent. You have no hands for the hate that will bind him. I turn to you, and both the joy and the somberness we inevitably come when palm turns to passion. And I sense the heaviness of this room in contrast to the joy in which we came in. Because that is what Holy Week invites into us, into our conflicted natures, where our self-interest meets the needs of the world. I'm going to give you a moment of some silence, but I turn to you and ask you about the work of your hands. What it is that is occupying your spirit and your heart, both as you maybe feel imbalanced today for whatever reason. Maybe someone on your journey is sick. Maybe there's some way in which you have been calling upon God to act in a certain kind of particular direction and you haven't received an answer. Whatever it is, where is your heart and your hands? And how will God continue to use them? Take just a moment of silence now.